We have a short session and a fairly substantive agenda today. So we will start by opening a public hearing on Senate Bill 733. Council.
Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 733 comes here to request the State Court Facilities Task Force.
Okay, we will start out on site.
I'm sure they can explain.
Okay.
I can.
Okay, it's dangerous to pause around here. Okay, I will first allow Representative Krieger to make some introductory remarks. Welcome to the committee. If I weren't chairing the committee, I would be down there with you as a member of the commission.
Thank you very much. Chair Burke, for the record, I'm Wayne Krieger, State Representative for District 1. I want to make a few comments about Senate Bill 733 and the need of capital construction dollars. During the interim, I served on the Public Commission of the Oregon Legislature, and the Commission looked carefully at the legislators' needs for adequate facilities and found that the wings here in our legislature were in great need of substantial renovation. Water pipes are corroded, electrical systems and computer networks were overloaded, air quality and circulation bad, and the place in some instances may be considered a fire hazard. The Commission recommended renovations occur as soon as possible, and leadership is seriously considering how to deal with this problem. Our ability to operate efficiently and safely depends on it. Now, we were dealing with buildings that are 30 to 35 years old, and the cost at the time was estimated, I think, in 2001 as being $17 million. And now it's $35 million plus. In the case of the court facilities, these buildings are 50 to 100 years old in some cases, and I think a couple of more than that. Most courthouses, including several in my district, are older, relatively smaller, and more in need of repair than the Capitol wings. Court operations are already affected by the inadequate facilities that house them, and the public has a right to a certain level of safety and comfort when using these important centers of community life. Although the courthouses are now the responsibility of the counties, we must, as a legislature, face the problem on the state level, since the fiscal problems of our counties are facing are only getting worse, and we've seen that maybe ease somewhat with a recent possible appropriation, but long term they've got the same problems. I participated, Senator Burick, with you in a work group that is proposing this bill and a companion bill that was in the House to begin to deal with this serious problem. And these bills are a place to start our discussions, and I hope that we can start them now. And there has been a little work group put together, talked a little bit about funding, and I think you'll hear from that later. But just from the time that you were there and talking to the Chief Justice, the more we look, the more we see there is a very legitimate need, and I think we have a very big responsibility not to let it linger like it has because of the safety issues, health issues, and the fact that when you linger, the costs are going to go up, and they're going to go up very, very rapidly. I think it's 10 to 12% per year. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Representative Krieger, and thank you for your service. Your attendance record was much better than mine. I was a member of this committee that worked in the interim, the Court Facilities Task Force, and one of the reasons I was interested in being there is the courthouse in my county, Multnomah County Courthouse, is one of the best examples of courthouses that are literally on the verge of falling down, and indeed would fall down if there were any an earthquake of any consequence. So thanks again for your work on this.
Thank you.
Thank you for coming.
Madam Chair, Klamath County, their courthouse did fall down in an earthquake, and it took a long time to rebuild, but it's a very nice facility now, and I feel safe when I'm in it.
Well, glad, and Senator Walker, I speak for the entire committee and the audience that we are glad you were not in it when it fell down. Okay, thank you. Chief Justice Demunis is with us today. And Jerry Gatos, two other members. And actually, all three of you are members of the committee, so you come on up and be our panel here.
Thanks.
Welcome to the committee, and I'm sorry about our abbreviated schedule today, so I appreciate your willingness to make your remarks short. Thank you.
Well, Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Paul Snyder, representing Association of Oregon Counties. Appearing this afternoon on behalf of Commissioner Nadeau, she had tried very hard to arrange her schedule to be here and just wasn't able to put that together. So I've submitted to the committee written testimony from Commissioner Nadeau and a letter from former representative and now Commissioner Luke. With regard to Senate Bill 733, this measure deals with an issue that's been a problem that's been growing for many years, and you've heard Representative Krieger describe what he's seen, and it's something that's occurred throughout the state. In 1981, the legislature passed legislation transferring responsibilities between the counties and the state. The state took over operational costs. The counties were obliged to continue for responsibility for facilities. Those obligations were based upon assumptions that have changed since 1981. One of the assumptions with respect to the counties was that their revenue sources, which historically had been very vital, including property taxes and timber receipts, would continue that way over time. That hasn't been the case. Measure 5 passed, limiting the ability of local governments to tax property. Measure 47 and 50 passed, further limiting our ability to raise revenues. And some things that were just getting started at the federal level, including the Clean Water Act and the Environmental Protection Act and the Endangered Species Act, took off full steam after that, and some of the members of this committee in particular know what some of the impacts were that on the ability to harvest timber in federal forests. All those things together played an important role in creating the problem that we're here asking you to address today. Senate Bill 733 creates a partnership. It creates a commission that's temporary. The commission would exist for a period of, I think, 4 years, but would report to you next legislative session. That's a very, very short time frame for a commission to do its work. It would include people who are designated by the legislature, by the judicial department, the state bar, and the counties. They would examine court facilities, and they would come to you with a report as to how bad the issue is and how to allocate the cost of dealing with the problem. All that takes a little bit of money, not a lot, but some. And we'd like your indulgence to work with our partners just a little bit longer to come up with a revenue stream that's acceptable to everyone. That, Madam Chair, is the extent of my testimony.
Thank you very much.
Chair Burdick and members of the committee, my name is Jerry Gatos. I'm a private practitioner in Eugene and also a member of the Board of Bar Governors and here representing the Oregon State Bar. 30 years ago, I actually worked in the Lane County courthouse as a prosecutor, and I can tell you that it's only deteriorated since that time. The heating and ventilating, the leaks that occur are extremely difficult to deal with for all folks who have to appear. I think most importantly, one of the things we discovered on the committee was that the courthouses are extremely important to all the communities in which they exist. They are places where people have the ability to dissolve marriages, they adopt children, sue on breach of contract, and resolve rights. And the rule of law is extremely important in trying to allow people to understand how to get along in each of our communities. And I know your constituents really appreciate the courthouses that exist and the judges that participate in them. We fully support, the Oregon State Bar fully supports Senate Bill 733, which creates that Courts Facility Planning Commission. Again, it's temporary, but it really makes sense to have someone assess the conditions. We are real lucky to have a brand new federal courthouse in Eugene at this point. And when you compare that courthouse to the courthouse that we have, both from a condition standpoint and how it reflects the majesty of the law, it's a significant difference. A healthy court system is crucial to economic development and to the maintenance of healthy communities. And unless we focus on this problem now, it's only going to get worse. So I encourage you at this time of historically low interest rates and a time where there's some focus on this issue to support this bill and move it forward. And I thank you for your time.
And thank you for coming. Mr. Chief Justice, they saved you till last.
Well, they saved the worst for last.
No, I don't think that's how it works.
Chair Burdick, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Paul DeMunez, Chief Justice of the Oregon Supreme Court. There are problems that confront our society that cannot be addressed by a single branch alone. the problem that you've heard discussed very ably by Representative Krieger, and as yourself also aware, and by my colleagues here this afternoon, is one that requires an interbranch solution. It requires the cooperation of all three branches to solve this problem. I would like to thank you personally and Representative Krieger for your participation on the Task Force on Court Facilities and particularly your guidance and support in this endeavor. As Mr. Snyder said, this is there was an agreement struck in 1981 with regard to ownership of these court facilities and the requirement to provide suitable and sufficient court facilities. Time has passed that agreement by. It is no longer simply a county problem. It's a statewide problem, and it's one that requires the three branches of government to cooperate to solve this problem. What we're asking here is that we make one first step in a long journey. This is not a problem that will be solved immediately, but we need to take that first step. Senate Bill 733, as my colleagues have ably described, is that first step and will permit us as a state and for the three branches of government to identify the size of this problem, to set the priorities, and to determine creative and innovative ways to solve it. Thank you very much.
And thank you for coming, Mr. Chief Justice. Are there questions from the committee? Senator Beyer.
I'm looking at page two of the bill, and I'm going down to section two, and you've got a bunch of things listed that this commission shall do. They shall study and make recommendations on criteria, shall prepare a detailed assessment of the court, of the costs of implementing changes, and then sub three. But then you get to sub four, it says that they shall make a recommendation on the establishment of a permanent state court facilities commission with authority to allocate funds. And that's where I have a problem, is when you've got this group, you're going to require them to make a recommendation. Granted, you're not going to, you don't say how they're going to make a recommendation, what their criteria is going to be to get to a recommendation. But when you're talking about an establishment of a permanent facility and allocating funds, I have a problem with that. You're requiring them to do something, but you're not telling us how they're going to get there.
Colleagues? Madam Chair, Senator Beyer, one of the things that this bill deals with is allocation of funds that another bill anticipates. And so to understand exactly how that was intended to operate, you need to look at the other bill, and the other bill creates a funding stream. The other bill is, frankly, undergoing some challenges right now. But this bill can stand alone without it, so long as there's an adequate funding stream in order to do the work of the commission. But the thought here was that someone needs to establish priorities, bring them to the legislature for approval, something similar to the way that the Sentencing Guidelines Task Force works, so that people who are assigned that responsibility make a suggestion to the legislature and say, we think these projects should be funded in this order using this kind of a funding arrangement, and we recommend them to you and we ask you to approve or modify. And I think that's what was intended by subsection 4, so that someone who's very close to the problem, who understands what each facility looks like and what the local generating capacity is of the revenue stream there, can make a recommendation to you, and then you would have the decision-making power to either accept, reject, or modify that.
I understand that, but you're talking here, Madam Chair, I guess if I could continue.
Yes, please.
You're talking about a 14-member commission that's created here, and you're telling that 14-member commission, they have to make a recommendation on establishing a full-time permanent commission, and that commission will have the authority to allocate funds. Okay, what happens if your 14-member commission ends up in a 7-7 tie on what a recommendation should be?
Madam Chair, Senator Beyer, then it's probably a non-starter.
Well, no, this bill says that they have to make a recommendation. What's the recommendation?
Madam Chair, Senator Beyer, it's I guess it's not unlike the Legislative Assembly. There's an even number in both houses, and without a majority, there's probably not a recommendation. I hope it doesn't reach that point, because the idea is for everyone to work collaboratively and over a period of time so that that kind of problem doesn't occur, but you raise a good issue.
May I respond?
Please,
Chair.
Chief.
Senator Beyer, I think you raise a very good point. I think that the intent here in that subsection and the context for other subsections is to have an independent mechanism for creating the priorities. In other words, everyone would like to be funded immediately. We're just looking to try to find an independent and neutral way of recommending how those priorities would be set and who would receive their funding. That's the general intent. I think you raise a practical problem, but the general intent of that legislation is to do that.
And I understand that. So I have no problem with the shalls and sections 1 through 3, because mm-hmm. that tells how they're going to go there. But in sub 4, it says they shall make a recommendation. And it doesn't tell me how a 14-member commission is going to get there if they're deadlocked.
Well, Council, did you have something to add to this?
Madam Chairman, as a committee, would it make it easier if it said may make recommendations?
Absolutely. It would make my heart burn.
Okay.
Yeah, because he raises a good point. You kind of ask yourself why you would need it at all. Why wouldn't you just establish that other commission in this if that's the outcome you wanted? So. Would that be acceptable?
Very good point. Mm-hmm. Yes, absolutely.
Yes, thanks so
okay.
much.
All right. Thank you, Senator Beyer. You found another one here. Okay. Are there any other questions from the committee?
Madam Chair, I just want to thank the parties, because we had a problem with our state hospital for years, and no one was really dealing with it. They just turned the other way and closed their eyes, and I think it's the same thing with the course facilities. We're just not paying attention to it. So establishing a commission, we did a task force in the state hospital. Now we're going to have a new facility, actually a couple of new facilities, and we're addressing the problem. So I think this is the first step. And you know, there's other people in the building who have eyes on the recording fee that was going to hopefully go to these facilities, which was really disturbing to me when I found out there were two competing interests. This is your best shot at trying to make the legislature aware of this issue. And you're right. It is an interbranch problem, because we've shoved it off to the counties and they can't fix it either. So I guess, wouldn't you agree? That would be my question.
Mr. Chief.
Chair Burdick, Senator Walker, I'd like to respond to that if I might. First of all, I agree with you. But I would like to give you just a brief history and give you my own personal view about this. I've studied this issue from afar, if you will. Oftentimes people refer to appellate judges as insular and isolated, and there's some truth to that. Till I became Chief Justice, I hadn't been back to the courthouses around the state. I'd had a statewide practice 17 years ago as a trial lawyer, but I had not been to these facilities, and so I became keenly aware of that. And I used much of my own personal credibility to get some of the best lawyers, legislators, and judges to embark on this project over this last year. This is a serious public safety mm-hmm. issue. It can no longer be addressed by ad hoc committees established by the Association of Oregon Counties, the Oregon State Bar, and the judicial branch. We need to have governmental buy-in to address this particular problem, because it is a public safety issue. It will not go away, and it will create a catastrophe if we don't do something about it. Thank you.
Thank you.
You're here.
Thank you. Senator Beyer.
Just a clarification. Senator Walker said that we shoved this problem off to the counties. And my understanding and correct me someone if I'm wrong, I wasn't here in 81 or I wasn't anywhere near the process, but I thought in 81 we took over operation of the courts, which had prior to that been a county function completely. But we said,
county, you're going to continue to maintain the buildings, your buildings. We didn't shove anything off to the counties, I don't believe.
Okay, okay. You know, I'll let you mince with my words, but basically the counties have no money to fix these facilities. So we rearranged the deck chairs, and it didn't work. So we got to rearrange them again in a different way. So that's what we're doing. So
I just wanted clarification for myself.
I'm okay. Senator Byers.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
We will close the public hearing on this bill, and I think that's all we have signed up. And we will open a very quick work session on Senate Bill 320 while we have our committee here. Council.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 320 comes to you at the request of the Senate and the Judiciary Committee on behalf of the Oregon Law Commission. It basically deals with juveniles and aid and assist, the issue being that they're unable to aid and assist in their own defense before the juvenile court. It sets forth standards and procedures for determining if a youth in a delinquency matter is unfit to proceed as a result of a mental disease or defect, and consequently is unable to, one, understand the nature of the proceedings against the youth, two, assist and cooperate with counsel, three, participate in his or her own defense, prohibits a court from basing a finding of unfitness to proceed solely on a, the con inability of the youth to remember the acts alleged in the petition, b, evidence that the youth committed the acts alleged in the petition while the youth was under the influence of intoxicants or medication, or c, the age of the youth, requires the youth participate in evaluation conducted by psychiatrist, psychologist, or clinical social worker if the court has reason to doubt the youth's fitness to proceed and there is probable cause to believe the factual allegations concerning the delinquency matter are true. And in terms of the committee, it does several other things relating to that. We also have the dash one amendments in front of you that are fairly extensive throughout the bill. If you want, I can go through them, or we could have Sam Sears from the Oregon Law Commission come up and explain them, whatever you prefer, Madam Chair.
I prefer to have you do it because I want to get it done quickly.
Okay, Madam Chair, members of the committee.
Not that Sam Sears wouldn't do it quickly.
Going over to page 2 of the bill, on line 28, it inserts a new line, says that the court finds that the department has not provided services, but the reasonable services would not have eliminated the need for removal. The court shall find that the department has made reasonable efforts, or if the Indian Child Welfare Act applies, active efforts to prevent the need for removal. The court shall include in written findings a brief description of what preventative or reunification efforts were made by the department. Madam Chair, members of the committee, then going over to page 4, and this is where the bulk of the rest of the amendments are. On line 4, delete provided and insert continued, so the court shall order the restorative services be continued. Probably more accurate language to use. And then on line 6, delete D. After D, delete the rest of the line, and then delete the rest of the line down to the end, which is placement of restorative services. So the line would now read, the youth may not be removed from the youth's current placement for restorative services, and then insert there on line 8, under this section, unless the court makes written findings that, and then it continues the findings on down through line 13, where it says after 12, insert an E, and the new finding would be a new section. If the court concludes that the youth must be removed from the youth's current placement, comma, the court must make written findings that the department has made reasonable efforts, or if the Indian Welfare Act applies, active efforts to prevent the need for removal of the youth from the youth's current placement and to make it possible for the youth to safely return to the youth's current placement upon completion of the restorative services. If the court finds the department has not provided services, but the reasonable services would have been eliminated the need for removal, the court shall find that the department has made reasonable efforts, or if the Indian Child Welfare Act applies, active efforts to prevent the need for removal. The court shall include in the written findings a brief description of what preventative and reunification efforts were made by the department. Line 13, it just changes E to F. Line 17, after deletes committed, inserts continued in restorative services. So the line would read, in no event may the youth be continued in restorative services for longer than whichever the following measures from the date the youth petition was filed. That's another change there. Then going down to line 21, 22, it just changes F to G. Line 29 removes and qualifications and inserts standards, so develop training and standards. And then on line 31, removes the word rules, and so it will say develop guidelines. And then on line 33, let me see. After the period insert, neither the parties nor the court is required to choose an evaluator from the list provided by the department. And then a new section 7 there, too. The department shall adopt rules necessary to carry out the provisions of subsection 6 of this section.
Thank you. This bill has been vetted pretty thoroughly by the work group on dependency, of which Senator Cruz is a member, and Senator Brown is happy with the bill as it stands, as amended by the Dash 1 amendment, and they have been very inclusive in their work group. So I think we're ready to send this bill on its way, if we could get a motion from Senator Beyer.
Madam Chair, I move the Dash 1 amendments into Senate Bill 320.
Senator Beyer has moved the Dash 1 amendment to Senate Bill 320. Is there any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. Senator Beyer.
Madam Chair, I have in my notes from the first hearing this bill has got a $644,000 fiscal.
I believe that's right. This has a subsequent to Ways and Means. Thank you for reminding us.
Madam Chair, does not have a prior referral to Ways and Means.
I thought this one did.
If it's $660,000, at least my I can check on it, but normally on my file at the top it will say Ways and Means. It does not.
Well, Madam Chair, I just have written down SMS that it was going to be one FTE at $163,000, $480,000 in program costs for a total fiscal of over $600,000.
I can go and check, Madam Chairman. I'm pretty sure it does not.
You have not received a fiscal, right?
Not because we. I do not. I don't.
Is there anybody here who can answer that question on the fiscal?
I have not. Don't have a fiscal in my file.
Okay. Welcome.
Hello, Chair Burdick and members of the committee. I'm Bill Bushko. I'm the manager of Children's Mental Health Services for the Department of Human Services, and there is a fiscal impact on this bill, and Senator Beyer was correct in the amount and the document that he must have in front of him.
So why don't we have a fiscal on this?
I'm sure I don't know. Maybe because of the amendments, the timing of the amendments.
Okay.
It was something that did come up in the first hearing discussion.
Okay.
Madam Chair.
Senator Przanski.
Sounds like if the chair wants to move it, we could move it with the referring
recommendations.
We can do that. I just am not happy that we don't have the actual fiscal in front of us. Okay, Senator Beyer, I would like an appropriate motion.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 320 as amended be referred to the Senate President's desk with the recommendation the bill go to the Ways and Means Committee.
Senator Beyer has moved Senate Bill 320 to the Senate President's desk with a recommendation that be referred to the Ways and Means Committee with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. Thank you. Thank you for catching that again, Senator Beyer. Okay, now we're going to open up a public hearing on House Bill 2348, and we may end up having to defer the one of my favorite bills, Senate Bill 950. My name is on it, that's all. We may have to defer that. Let's see how we do for time. So, Council, we will open a hearing on House Bill 2348A.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill House Bill 2348A comes with the request of the House Indian Judiciary Committee for the Governor Kulongoski. Requires an individual health care insurance policy other than disability income policy to provide coverage or reimbursement and expenses for the medical treatment of injuries or illnesses caused by the insured's use of alcohol or controlled substance to the same extent as injuries not caused by the insured's use of drugs or alcohol.
Okay, we'll start off with Joe O'Leary from the Governor's Office. Welcome back to Judiciary, Joe. I think this is your first appearance since you deserted us.
It's
Mr.
great
O'Leary,
to be back.
For those who don't know, is our former Judiciary Committee staff last session. We miss him.
Chair Burdick, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Joe O'Leary, Senior Policy Advisor to Governor Kulongoski, and it is a pleasure and a privilege to be back in Senate Judiciary again, and thank you to the committee for giving this bill a hearing. The policy behind this bill, Madam Chair, members of the committee, is enhancing access to drug and alcohol treatment. This bill does that by ensuring that individual insurance health policies cover medical treatment for injuries that are related to or caused by drug or alcohol use. This applies only to the individual insurance market. There is a similar provision that already exists in the group insurance market, which is relatively a lot bigger than the individual market. And this bill would bring that policy in line with what exists currently in the group market. It repeals language that is currently in the statute that permits insurers to actually deny claims if the injury or condition was caused by or related to drug or alcohol treatment. Do you have a question, Madam Chair?
Use,
excuse me. Thank you.
Okay, so for example, if somebody came in with liver problems, the doctor could say it's related to drug or alcohol use, and then they could deny treatment for the liver problems?
Madam Chair, I think that's exactly right under one hypothetical. Another hypothetical could be an actual accident where in which someone fell and broke their leg while intoxicated or under the influence of a controlled substance. That'd be another scenario. The good thing, I think, about this language in the bill, and the critical part here is on page 1, between lines 9 and 14, is that it's written and crafted in a way intentionally to not provide any windfall, if you will, for someone who does have a drug or alcohol abuse issue. There's no bonus, if you will. If a policy would not pay for a sober person, in other words, it would be permitted to not pay for someone with drug or alcohol issues. I also note that it's prospective in its scope. It doesn't relate back to existing policies, but would only apply to policies from the effective date forward. So that I've described to you the direct impact of this, but I also want to describe to you just for a moment the indirect impact, because this is addressing a cultural issue in the medical profession. There is, because this exclusion has existed for so long, there's a belief among doctors that if they make notations in their files that an injury or condition is related to drug or alcohol use, that they will be denied payment by the insurance company. And as a result, and there is actually a member of the Oregon Medical Association who's going to testify to this issue here in a moment, so I won't go too much into it, but as a result, this has essentially created a culture in which there is a disincentive for doctors to fully and candidly discuss drug and alcohol issues with their patients and refer those patients to treatment. I will add to that that there is some really remarkable data that shows that a brief intervention, there's been a study from an emergency room that emergency room doctors, that brief intervention for drug and alcohol issues and referrals to treatment can reduce the recurrences of driving under the influence of intoxicants incidents by pretty remarkable numbers, and I will get you that that study if you would like it. So that's the cultural impact, and then finally, there's also a data impact. When the MEP task force last session was trying to gather information about the scope and breadth of the meth problem in Oregon, they were calling around to hospitals and medical organizations asking about how many of their intakes in emergency rooms were related to meth, and they got good anecdotal information, but what they were told was that their doctors don't keep track of that in their files, and they don't keep track of it exactly because of this culture and this perception that they will be denied if they note it. That really is my testimony. I do want to mention to you that the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association, the Oregon District Attorneys Association, and the Oregon Hospital Association all are in support of this bill, and I'm happy to take any questions that you might have.
Thank you. Any questions of Mr. O'Leary?
It's just a comment, Madam Chair. There were a lot of goofy things that came out of the 1950s that we thought were going to fix problems and
including some of us, Senator Walker.
Yeah, I know. I'm a goofy 1956 baby, so thank you for reminding me of that.
You're welcome.
Oh, I just appreciated the little history about where it came from.
Thank you. Any other questions? Thank you, Joe.
Thank you very much.
Okay, Dr. Jim Lace. Welcome to the committee.
Madam Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jim Lace. I'm a pediatrician from Salem, and I represent the Oregon Medical Association and the Oregon Pediatric Society. I'm here to testify in favor of House Bill 2348. Just very briefly, you heard a little bit of the background information. From the practicing standpoint, what really does happen in emergency rooms or elsewhere, if a patient comes in typically with trauma, say a broken leg, and they could have been drunk, they could have been under the effect of meth or some other drug, that will not be put into the diagnosis. They'll be diagnosed with a broken leg, and that will be left alone, typically because you don't get paid. That sounds kind of stupid, but that's just the way it is. And so that's the culture that's out there, as was pointed out. And we think that actually that all should be part of the patient information. If we have on-site people available to start working with them on alcohol, which is available in some emergency rooms, I think that's a great starting point. When you get down to the issues of meth and actual, you know, other drugs in that category, that's a little different because you typically don't have something on site, you know, for dealing with that. But nonetheless, you have to identify that that's an issue, and then you have to work with the patient, and you have to work trying to get them into some kind of program, you know, to rehabilitate them. But if you hide the information, then you don't know. As was pointed out, we're very interested in finding out from meth task forces just how many people are entering into the emergency rooms, how much money gets spent doing that. We have data that comes from other states, other programs at a national level, but it's very hard to get that in Oregon because we sort of typically hide that. We have anecdotal information, but we don't actually have accurate information on that. So we are in support of House Bill 2348. We think it's a good bill, and it's one step forward. We're hoping that there will be a alcohol tax that comes out of this session to help fund the programs for treatment for adults in the state. So far, we haven't had any movement on that, but that's another problem that we don't adequately fund our mental health system for adults, especially with drug and alcohol addiction. So I can stop there. You've got my written testimony, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Appreciate it. Are there any sanctions for doctors who might get caught not revealing all they know about?
No. Nobody will come and take my license away because I'm not lying. I'm just not telling you everything. Mm-hmm. So, you know, if you want a cost shift, you can put everything down there, and then you get the claim denied. And so you get told very soon, don't use that as a diagnosis. So you just, and it, you could say, well, gosh, it's not that important. You're just taking care of the trauma, you're taking care of the injury, the head injury, the broken leg, whatever. But really, if you're going to go after the whole patient model, the whole patient care, you really want to be able to address all the different diagnoses that are on there. And that's an accurate way of doing that. And so if you come into the hospital and you've had a brain injury, and say you're involved in MVA and you've got 10 different problems, I should feel free to put all those 10 down for anybody that's going to be caring for you subsequently. But if we're going to hide that you are an alcoholic or that you have a meth addiction or something else like that, that's not in your best interest to put that, you know, and keep it hidden from, you know, the eyes.
To your knowledge, do doctors distinguish the testimony from Mr. O'Leary was that the larger group insurance policies already cover things that are related to drugs and alcohol. Do doctors just differentiate?
Typically, you don't know that at the point of entry, and you're taking care of the patient. And so if you knew that, you could maybe go ahead and do that. But since you do have non-coverage, typically you don't get the accurate information. And so just from the on-the-street sort of thing, that typically will be hidden because you don't know when that patient comes in what if they have coverage, if they don't have coverage, what's excluded, what isn't, you know, excluded.
Do you think this practice is prevailing enough that there really wouldn't be any financial impact on insurance companies if this went through? In other words, would you argue that there would be no additional claims costs because they're already being paying these claims?
In other words, they're already in for their broken leg. Mm-hmm. They're paying for their broken leg. It depends on what the insurance covers in terms of addiction treatment, alcohol, drugs, what have you, and that would depend on the policy. But that wouldn't necessarily be determined right in the emergency room. So that's an interesting question, because the bill is going to hopefully would get paid. However, if it gets denied because of that, in other words, the person that came in was obviously doing something totally illegal, and I would sympathize exactly. Why should somebody be paying for something that's illegal? That's caused by illegal activity. That makes common sense to all of us. Why should you pay for it? Well, then what happens then is that you do the whole cost shift argument. The hospitals will suck it up. The doctors will have to suck it up in some way. And so we think we all ought to be together on the same playing field. And whatever the diagnosis is, not be afraid to put that out and make sure that a service is going to be covered.
Okay. Thank you very much. Questions from the committee? Thank you. We'll go to Sharon Kelly and Anna Peterson. Hi, Sharon. Welcome.
Senator Burdick, Chair Burdick. My name is Sharon Kelly. I'm a member of the Governor's Council on Alcohol and Drug Abuse Programs, and I'm here today to provide testimony in support of House Bill 2348, which repeals the Uniform Individual Accident and Sickness Policy Provision Law, the UPPL law. In 2006, the Governor's Council on Alcohol and Drug Abuse Programs passed a resolution called Ending Discrimination. This resolution was based upon recommendations from the American Bar Association National Policy Board called Join Together. At the top of the list of this resolution was the repeal of the UPPL law, and here's why.
Excuse me, Sharon. Sure. We're under a really tight schedule today, and we do have your written testimony. I was wondering if you might be able to summarize it.
I think that the testimony that you've already heard really states the reasons. And what I wanted to do was to draw some of the facts and figures and to point out that it was a bill passed in 1947 federally that several states, not the majority of states, have already repealed it. Washington repealed it in 2004. Mm-hmm. And is actually doing a study so that they know exactly what the consequences are and the cost effectiveness of the approach. I also state the University of Washington has already done some studies in talking about some of the savings from this repeal. We don't know, because the study isn't finished, exactly how much the costs are, but we assume, most studies assume, that because there's non-reporting, that it's really not going to cost the insurance companies much of anything at all. I think the final thing that I want to say, especially from the Governor's Council, is that addiction is a treatable chronic disease and should be treated accordingly. And this is the UPPL law was very discriminating, although not intending to be discriminating. We do support House Bill 2348, but when it was on the House side, there was some amendments made. There was one in particular amendment that we do have some concerns over, and that is on, I think I have the same thing that you have. On line 10, it says, other than a disability income policy. And that was held out as an exception. And the disability policies are referred to those that make cash payments, like the Aflac payments that we've seen on TV so often.
Amplant.
Right.
You actually sound like a doctor today with her cold.
Helps to have a cold. Sorry about that.
The problem that we see with it, with this particular amendment, is that it's just as discriminating as the UPP law was. And our concern is that even though the effect on Oregonians will be widespread with the repeal, there'll be still some people who will be caught up in what we think is a discriminating policy. The compromise position may be that an illegal activity caused by alcohol and drug use might eliminate payments from disability income policies. But this is a big policy question that I think you should consider as to whether or not you want to leave in that amendment or whether you want to alter it accordingly.
And I take it you're urging that we alter it.
I am, and we are, yes.
Okay, thank you. Questions, Senator Walker?
I have a question. Did you address this issue on the House side in
the
committee?
Yes, and I provided the same testimony that I just provided to you.
Okay, and they just sent us the bill with that provision in it anyway.
Yes, they did, yes.
Okay.
And we so stated our concerns.
Thank you. But it even if this amendment were to stay, the bill is an improvement over the current.
It's a huge improvement. And we would be one of what I think is maybe six states to repeal it. And, you know, that's a very good thing.
And, Madam Chair, I also want to thank Ms. Kelly for pointing out this was a 1947 law.
You're not accountable. You're totally unaccountable.
Yeah.
And she only says that because the chair happened to have been born at the end of 1947. So. Okay. Any other questions from the committee? Thank you. Ms. Peterson, welcome.
Thank you, Chair Burdick and committee. I'm Anna Peterson, and I chair the Governor's Meth Task Force. I appreciate this opportunity to come today to tell you, in support of House Bill 2348A, that the Governor's Meth Task Force is solidly in favor of this bill, and for specific reasons, some of which have been mentioned already. We learned early on as a task force that we needed accurate and verifiable information about methamphetamine, use, methamphetamine trafficking, et cetera. But what we found was that we were unable to get accurate information about people who were reporting to physicians and to emergency rooms and other medical facilities because of the laws that placed a constraint on the disclosure of that information, particularly laws that or rules that governed the disclosure of alcohol or drug use as a cause of the or a relating cause of an accident or injury, because then that would affect, of course, insurance. Back to the issue of why does the Governor's Meth Task Force need this accurate information, we need to fully understand the scope of the problem so that we can make policy suggestions and so that we can support other types of legislation that have to do particularly with treatment services for people who are addicted, because without that specific data, we're only operating on anecdotal comments from emergency room physicians and from treatment providers in the medical fields. So we're here solidly to support the passage and urge you to help support the passage of this bill.
Thank you for your testimony. Any other questions from the committee? Thank you very much. For the record, Rob Beauvais and Mike Stafford both signed up in favor, and they both had to leave. So.
No, they're here. Rob's over there.
Mike's they crossed their names off.
Oh, we would be repetitive. Yeah. Oh, got it.
Okay. All right.
Madam Chair, I have to go to another committee, but is there anyone here who can answer the question why the disability income policies were excluded?
Let's see if our next witness might provide some insight into that. Ted Hughes has signed up on this.
I expected an insurance person to be able to answer that.
Thank you, Madam Chairman, members of the committee.
Ted Hughes here today representing Aflac.
Aflac. You're saying Aflac. It wrong.
Aflac is a national insurance company, I'm sure you know, that is not in the business of paying medical expenses. They write health policies, individual contracts with you. One, for example, would say if you catch cancer or however you get cancer, this policy agrees to pay you $155 a day all the time you are diagnosed with it. So it's basically a contract between the individual and Aflac. They have some 12 of these supplemental insurance policies, contracts, I mean. And we thought that this amendment, Ian Gross, the one that you're talking about, Senator Walker, excuse me.
I was a rep once.
I go back one time with you. Kind of excluded us because we do not pay medical expenses. We pay the individual for extraordinary expenses incurred because of a medical condition. And we were hoping that we don't think it's the intent of the sponsors of the bill to include these kinds of policies that do not pay medical expenses but pay individuals on a individual contract basis. Aflac has more than a cancer policy. They have roughly 12 different supplemental insurance policies.
Mr. Hughes, do any of your policies have exclusions for people whose diagnosis is the result of drug or alcohol use?
Some of them do. Madam Chairman, it's my understanding that some of them do and some of them do not have that inclusion. But most of them do, from what I can understand.
Mm.
I think Aflac's concern is the expense involved. They're not. This bill, we're certain, was not aimed at their business practices, but they're going to have to rewrite all their contracts and on. You can understand why they are hoping that this language may cover them, because it does mention medical expense in line 9 through 14. But it's so gray, and I talked to the insurance administrator before, and I've talked to Joel from the governor's office about that. No one's sure whether we're covered or not, and it would be a simple way to cover us, but I don't have an amendment now. And it sounds to me like I don't know if I would get the permission of these proponents to include it or not. But we could easily include it by adding to disability income. Any other insurance contract that does not provide payment to or reimbursement for medical expense. And we'd feel much better if that was included. It would be very clear that these policies are not covered. So I wanted to bring Aflac's concern to you. They just got to me 2 days ago and said, we reread A.N. Gross 2348. It's so unclear to us whether we're covered or not. Can you discuss it with the committee? And so I said, I'd certainly like to, and that's what I've done.
Okay, well, we will take that under advisement. Mr. Hughes, any questions from the committee?
Madam Chair, I had a short-term disability policy once, and I got rid of it because it was too expensive. And would that be what we're referring to here, counsel, is a disability income policy?
He wasn't talking about the disability part of the amendment. He was talking about the medical.
Well,
referring.
Yeah, but see, he gets excluded because they don't pay. They're a supplemental income policy for when you get sick.
Madam Chairman, Senator Walker, that's correct. 12. I told you we had 12 different policies.
You don't have a disability element to your policy, though.
Yes, we have a
diagnosis.
We have a short-term disability policy.
Yeah, they have.
Yes, we do. Out of one of the 12
is
short-term
disability.
I had nothing to do with offering this amendment on the House. I believe that was drafted by the Hospital Association, if I'm not mistaken.
So my question was, does that Is this definition of disability income, does that also include a short-term disability or long-term disability?
Mr. O'Leary, why don't you hop on up here? You look like you're anxious.
Madam Chair, Senator Walker, Joe O'Leary for the record. I would love to offer you Joel Ario, who's the insurance administrator at DCBS, who is much more schooled in these things.
Our eagle eye should have spotted you. Thank you, Mr. O'Leary. You are hiding very well, Mr. Ario.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Joel Ario, the insurance administrator with the Department of Consumer and Business Services. The disability income does include the short-term disability policies. The reason the House committee put that in was at the behest of Mr. Mangan, who explained that disability income policies don't pay for medical expenses. They only pay income to people who are disabled, and some of those policies include disability caused by alcoholism and other drug abuse, and some of them don't. And the argument to the committee was, if you make them all cover that, then the people who want to buy the cheaper policies that exclude it would end up paying more, and the committee bought that argument as to disability and so excluded it. And I think part of it was the theory that what this bill is really aiming at is to make sure that doctors don't underdiagnose the problem, and so there's no issue with doctors in relation to disability policies, and there may be no issue with respect to some of Mr. Hughes' clients as well. But the committee drew the line in the House at disability income and did have under consideration broader exclusions at that point, and decided not to do, they sort of said, we're going to do disability income and we're going to do no others. But it's a policy choice for the committee. If you want to just focus on the problem as defined by Mr. O'Leary, then the only policies you'd care about under this law would be the ones that actually pay doctors for treating this these conditions. The bill, as it's worded, does include some policies that don't fit in that category.
Thank you. And I see counsel has his hand up, too. I had an additional question. What if you were at your office party and you were drinking alcohol at the office party and you fell off the chair because you got a little excited, and you ended up being disabled then for a couple of months, then you can't claim it on your short-term disability policy because it's alcohol-related, but I bet you could go through your workers' comp, and that would be interesting.
Madam Chair, Senator Walker, yes, I believe you're absolutely correct that under this bill, as currently worded, that this short-term disability policy would not pay in that situation, but there'd be other coverage, for instance, workers' comp, that would respond to the situation. And under this bill, your health policy, if it happened to be outside of workers' comp because it was outside the office after work and not associated with work, then your health policy would pay for it under this. So
I'm getting my questions answered. Thank you.
Counsel.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Mr. Ariel, I have two questions for you. To the extent that Aflac is selling a disability income policy, my assumption is it would not be covered under this bill. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, committee counsel, yes, that would be my interpretation.
And one further question, Mr. Ariel, if I may, Madam Chair. To the extent that they're selling a health insurance policy, it would be covered under this act, would it not?
Madam Chair, Consul Taylor, yes, a health insurance policy other than a disability policy would be covered.
And Chair, one further question. So that would depend on the nature of the contract, would it not?
Madam Chair, Consul Taylor, yes, it would depend on the contract, although there are in the statute and under 743, there's a definition of health insurance, which includes all kinds of policies, and then there's a subdivision of health benefit policies, which are major medical, and then there are the so-called limited benefit policies, most of what that category covers what Aflac sells, and that all of those are swept in specifically to this bill by the use of the phrase health insurance policy.
Thank you.
Thank you for the legislative history. We may need it at some point. Okay. Thank you. Any other questions from the committee? Close the public hearing on House Bill 2348. I think we might want to consider moving this bill. Does anybody have any problems with doing that?
Madam Chair, yeah, I'd just I guess I had a question how an insurance mandate bill got to this committee and whether or not it should be considered in the health policy or one of the health committees, because it is an insurance mandate bill.
Well, it's also drug-related, and of course, Senator Beyer, you know that we are here to serve, and we take what we get, and we do our best with it.
I understand. I guess the question I'd have, there is a statute somewhere I was looking for. I can't find it, saying that before we pass insurance mandates of a certain magnitude, that there has to be a report. There's supposed to be a report issued on the effect of that mandate on the insurance industry, and I'm sure that Mr. Powell could enlighten us on that.
That's news to me.
It's in statute.
I think Dr. Lace's testimony was there wouldn't be any impact because the doctors would go on doing what they're doing now and they're not going to report it. But
come on, John.
I got it.
Joel, why don't you come up and join us, too?
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is John Powell, representing Regents Blue Cross Blue Shield. I don't know where to start. This bill started out with a phone call to my office asking if we had any problems repealing the UPPL. And it took me 2 days to find out what that was. And I called a lot of people. It is a mystery. And I was born probably the same month and the same year you were. So we've been around since this thing, and I couldn't find out what it was. And I'm not sure about its origins. Kind of sounds like maybe after Prohibition or something. And then Oregon actually adopted it, I believe, in 1967. And I was in college at the University of Oregon at the time, and they were burning buildings. I was watching and protesting, and it was very ugly. And I know my first partner in lobbying was Bob Davis, who at the time, in 1967, was Tom McCall's executive assistant. And he was sent to the University of Oregon to actually close it. So my sense is the legislature wasn't happy with the kids on the campuses, and maybe this is why this thing boiled out and became part of the law in Oregon. I just don't know. Health insurers have not opposed this because Regents and the other larger carriers are not doing this. We pay those claims like any other claim. I think there are a few carriers that have it in their filing, but I don't think they're actually administering it that way because we couldn't find anybody who was not paying claims that were the result of activity of use of alcohol or controlled substances. So we don't have any problem with the bill. The problems arose when the language was added to say you have to pay and the term health insurance was used. And as Mr. Ariel pointed out, that term in our statute doesn't mean what you think it means. It's got all of these other monoline and sublines and disease-specific policies are considered, quote, health insurance under the statute. And so it's pulled all of those policies in there, including accidental death. And that might be one you want to look at as well. We haven't had any policy. We don't think it'll have a large impact on insurance because we're paying them now, so it will not have an impact.
And you don't feel like the reference to the medical treatment, you don't feel that saves you from coverage under, say, accidental death? Because they're talking about medical treatment. I assume people who are accidentally killed don't need medical treatment.
Madam Chair, I do know that there are provisions in most accidental death policies that for the reason of the term of the policy, accident, would potentially exclude activity of an illegal nature. So if you died as a result of an overdose, for example, that probably would not pay. If you were 25 years old and you OD'd, I don't think an accidental death policy today would pay. I believe under this provision that you're looking at, they may have to, and others could answer that question better than I, but I think it's at least questionable in there. They may not have to.
Mr. Ario, can you comment on that?
Madam Chair, John and I have already had one shouting match today, so I'm glad we're here on the same page on this bill. I don't believe that accidental death situation would be covered under this bill for the reason that you stated, that it's about medical treatment, although when I don't have the bill right in front of me now, but when I was looking at it a minute ago, I think the last time it talks about expense there at the end of the phrase, it doesn't qualify with the word medical. And so probably if you put the word medical again in front of the word expenses there, then it would be crystal clear that this bill only applies when somebody's paying medical expenses to sober people but not paying them to drunk people at that case. I'm obviously shorthand here, that distinction. That's a language I think that artfully solves the problem of all these limited benefits, because it says as long as you're not paying medical expenses to regular, in a regular situation, you don't have to pay them simply because the person happened to be intoxicated. So the provision only comes into play when you would be paying everybody else and you say, I'm going to pay everybody else except, I'm going to pay medical expenses for everybody else except the intoxicated person. That's the intent of the language, and I believe it does it. And for that reason, I believe even the disability language could probably come out of the bill and it would still work, because disability policies don't pay medical expenses. A couple other quick points. Senator Beyer is right that there is a provision, I think it's 743-700, that says any mandate is supposed to have a study with it. We've looked at those and tried to collect them on occasion, and it's, that statute is honored in the breach of many of them passed without having the statement required there, but it is in the statute. And then the other thing to say about this is, while it could be construed as a mandate, John is absolutely right that the practice of insurers is to pay in these situations. We talked about the group market as always pays in these situations. It's only the individual market that we allowed them to have these exclusions because of this statute. By itself, that's only 5% of our market, so it's a pretty small sliver. And then within that, Regions, his company, pays. Kaiser, the second biggest insurer, pays. There are a couple who I won't name who don't or have policies that don't, but our best information is the same as his, which is that's antiquated language, and rarely does a health company actually go, gee, I'm not going to pay. But the doctor, so the doctors were wrong when they said these things are denied. The problem is, though, in theory, they could be denied by a few companies, and as they testified later, the doctor never knows whether this is that situation. So just to be super cautious, they react as if it's not going to be paid. So insurers deserve credit for paying these things, but I think this bill would clear it up, and it wouldn't cost, I don't think it cost anything, probably, in the way it's worded now.
Senator Beyer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. From what I just heard from the two of you, and correct me, please, if I'm wrong, that the original bill is better than the amended bill. The original bill just repeals the statute and says that it only applies to policies written after the effective date.
Mr. Chair, Senator Beyer, I don't believe that's true for this reason. The statute, if you simply repeal it, then the statutes in the individual side would be silent as to whether this exclusion is allowed or not allowed. And the general rule in insurance regulation is if an exclusion is not prohibited, then we do not have the authority to deny exclusions when they're included in a form filed with us. So if the statutes remain silent, there would be this argument. It would be inconsistent with kind of the history of this session, but the argument that could be brought to us is, look, the statute used to say that you could only have alcoholism exclusions if they were worded in a certain way. The legislature got rid of that restriction. So the meaning of that is that all forms of alcoholism exclusion are allowed, and you don't have any authority anywhere in the code to disagree with that interpretation. So that's why we thought it important to have an affirmative replacement for the current language. Not necessary on the group side, but is necessary for the reason I just stated on the individual side.
Madam Chair and Senator Beyer, I have a different reason. Bruce Bishop's my friend. His client needed that language in there, and I support leaving it in for that reason.
Your friend?
Yes.
Sitting back there smiling, Mr. Powell.
And,
never knew he was your friend before.
Yeah, I'd also say on the disability side, there is the word expenses in there, and I think that would cause them trouble if disability was taken out, because it says medical expense, and then some, I think, expenses stands alone. And again, if you're offered a, if you're going to be in a pool of people who agree to an income based on normal disability issues, then a more restrictive pool that says if you go out and, you know, again, an overdose situation, you want to live that lifestyle, this pool is not for you. If you want to be in that pool and get the savings of that, that you should be, that should be an option to the consumer to have a more restrictive policy. So, again, I would urge you to leave that in there as well.
Okay. So bottom line of yours is no impact, no opposition.
Yes.
Thank you. Okay. Thank you very much.
And
any other questions from the committee?
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Do you have any more questions?
Well, you had originally said you needed the word medical in front of expenses on line 10. And now
Madam Chair, Senator Barr, that was me who suggested that would be one way to deal with the disability. If you put that word in there, then, as John just pointed out, then the argument for needing the disability income exception would perhaps go away, although it is true that if you put the word medical in front, you may have Mr. Bishop back up here about how that may be too broad a set of terms. So the House settled on it the way it is, maybe.
It's you know, it's a grammatical issue more than anything else, because it's actually on line 12, Senator Byer. At least that's the way I followed him. I'm only looking at the amendment here.
Oh, I don't have the word expenses on my line 12.
Yeah, exactly. And he wanted those in. You don't? Oh, it's on line 13 on the actual bill.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, okay.
So if you put it medical before expenses, but then after expenses, it says expenses arising from treatment of injuries.
Yeah.
So that's medical expenses. So
sort of redundant.
It would be redundant to put it in. It wouldn't be the first time the legislature would put a redundant word in, but it would be. Do you agree it would be redundant?
I mean, next year's correction.
Madam Chair, again, I don't have it specifically.
Bill, yeah.
I don't have it specifically in front of me again. If it says arising from expenses arising from treatment
of injuries or illness.
If the word treatment's there, then I agree with you, it'd be redundant. I was remembering it to say arising from expenses related to alcohol.
No. Arising from treatment of injuries or illnesses.
It is hard to see how a disability income payment would be an expense arising from treatment of alcoholism.
Right.
So that's the.
Members of the committee, I take it from the discussion here, the committee means medical expenses when it's referring to expenses. Is that correct?
That's correct. Right. But we don't need that word there
that's
again.
That's in our legislative history now for all intents.
Medical treatment.
Well,
that way we won't have to burden the scriveners of a future session.
A lot of conversation about a bill from 1947, a.k.a. 1967.
That was darn John Powell, he just loves mandates. That's just amazing.
Yeah, right. Thank you.
Okay.
Casting aspersions on the University of Oregon.
So, Senator Byer, I don't know if you still, still have any concerns with this bill. We can hold this bill. I'm prepared to move it today, but we can hold this if people want to hold it.
Move it.
I can't interpret his Italian signals over there.
Go. He wants to go. Okay. Close the hearing on House Bill 2348. Open a work session.
He wants to go. He's loco.
Senator Barr.
Madam Chair, I'm going to let Senator Cruz move this bill.
Senator Cruz, do you have a motion here?
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2348 A engrossed to the floor of the Senate with a defast recommendation.
Senator Cruz has moved House Bill 2348A engrossed to the Senate floor to do pass. Any discussion?
Madam Chair, just please record me as an opposition.
We will definitely do that. Okay, why don't you take the roll real quick?
Senator Cruz?
Aye.
You have to vote for it.
Aye.
Senator Walker?
Aye.
Senator Byer?
No.
Chair Burton?
Aye. Senator Cruz will carry this bill.
I'm going to get you, buyer.
Committee, I'll leave it to you. We could probably start and finish 9:50 in 5 minutes would be my guess.
I was supposed to be in committee at 3, and I'm up in another committee at a bill at 3:30, so I have to go.
Okay. 9:50 will be put on until tomorrow. The judiciary. Oh, excuse me, till Monday. Judiciary is adjourned.
Be prepared for the question.